Welcome back to the Real Talk with Dana podcast, where we talk all things nutrition, health, fitness, and mindset with a healthy side of sarcasm. I'm your host, Dana Montes of Real Food with Dana. I'm a nutritionist and body image coach, teaching women how to heal their relationship with food and their bodies, ditch the diet cycle for good, and truly thrive with real food, one delicious meal at a time. Morning, friends, or honestly, whatever time you listen to this podcast that it currently happens to be while you're listening. Today, we have a very intriguing episode, I guess you could say. We're taking a long, hard look about what we believe about ourselves and why. So yeah, this one's going to be a little bit of a deep one. So today's interview is with Amy Smith, who is a self-proclaimed sassy-ass life coach who specializes in all things confidence, who helps aspiring badasses stand up for themselves without being assholes. So yeah, you guessed it. There is some swearing in this episode. So if you don't appreciate it, you might not like this episode. However, I know that you probably will like the content. So what Amy is trying to tell all of her clients and everyone that she speaks to is that it's time to let go of all of the people-pleasing and cultivate some serious self-worth. In the meat of this episode, we are talking about the fear of not belonging, of people-pleasing, and why it's so detrimental to our mental and physical health, our beliefs about worthiness and how they drive our behaviors, constant comparison and perfectionism, and basically all of the things. This is kind of like a Brené Brown type episode, if I can call it that. This is the type of episode where if you're anything like you, me, you'll want to listen once and then probably listen again and maybe take some notes and do some serious thinking about your life and how these things we're talking about have played out in your own life, because that's exactly what I did. And by the way, yes, again, if you don't like cursing, you probably won't like this episode, but there are knowledge bombs sprinkled into this episode. No, not sprinkled into this episode. It's like a waterfall of knowledge bombs about beliefs about yourself and worthiness and the fear of not belonging and people pleasing and perfectionism and all the things. And I know you guys are going to love it. I would love if you could, well, introduce yourself to the listeners and then also tell us more about your personal health journey, specifically about confidence and boundaries and how you even learned about what those concepts were in the first place.
Oh man. Well, I love, first of all, that you incorporate the health piece, because I think a lot of times we don't realize that some of the reasons why we have a stomach ulcer might be because of our relationship with our mother, or we don't, a lot of times we like to compartmentalize our internal narrative and what's happening with us versus our external body or our health. And it's very much tied together. So my situation is, I'm assuming that there are many people out there who can very much relate. So a bit of context, I grew up in an extremely conservative born again Christian family. And my father had a master's in divinity and a doctorate in ministry. So, I mean, we weren't fucking around over there. And so I grew up with a lot of dogma around what was right and wrong, and just a lot of motivation from fear and guilt and a lot of shame. And there was a lot of kind of, why am I a part of this family? Gosh, you know, I'm this eccentric kind of wild-hearted child who just would love to have been in a hippie commune. And here I am, you know, just a total Bible thumper. And I'm like, what? How did I get born into this family? So fast forward probably, I don't know, almost three decades. And I had the fortune and misfortune to lose my father in 07. And I say fortune just because it really was one of the most beautifully intimate experiences to be with somebody as they passed. And so the day of my father's service, I had a very rich career in makeup artistry at the time. So I knew without a shadow of a doubt that A, I was going to speak at the service, and B, I was going to do his makeup, the actual mortuary makeup for his deceased body. So here I am thinking I'm daughter of the year award, you know, I'm speaking to this crowd of hundreds and I'm doing makeup on my dead father. And my mom later that day found it the most opportune time to say that she felt that my father and her had failed, and that because the three of us, myself and my two siblings, my two brothers, weren't, quote, walking with the Lord. Now, another bit of context, I was by all contexts the good child. I had started working since I was 14. I worked in a company that paid for my tuition. I paid for all my college myself. Got married when I was young, moved out. Both my brothers did jail time. I mean, it was sort of this, how the hell can you lump me in and say, like, your children are disappointments? And the only thing that I could really muster kind of in that moment was to say, well, you probably shouldn't say that to a child. And she kind of just said, well, that's just how I feel. And that, I think, was kind of the impetus for me to realize that there were going to be costs to actually standing up for myself. And there would be a cost, conversely, of not standing up for myself. And what that meant was I was going to have to choose between making them happy or making me happy. And when it came down to that, I chose me. And the trajectory thereafter was extremely combative and adversarial when I kind of found my footing and was like, no, this is who I'm about. I'm a liberal, and I'm a, you know, I love free love, and I'm, you know, all these things. And I kind of came out of the Christian closet, so to speak, or the agnostic closet, I guess. My relationship with my mom became extremely combative. And I wanted to talk about all the things. Let's talk about abortion. Let's talk about gay rights. Let's talk about, let me just take you to school on all these things. And it wasn't until having some blowout fights and being so incredibly embarrassed of my own behavior and realizing that there's a different way to communicate that I kind of stumbled upon what I teach now, which is this dichotomy of you can speak up for yourself, you can be incredibly assertive, but you can also be extremely kind and loving and compassionate at the same time. But I'm sure you see this too a lot of times in our society. It's, oh, you want to get anything done, you must don the masculine and you must be aggressive and better not ever be vulnerable. And so that kind of has been what has led me to doing the work that I do now, which is twofold. It's knowing internally that who you are matters, that your voice matters, your wants, your opinions, your needs all matter. And then the external piece of, okay, well now, how does that relate to actually communicating with people in my life? What does it sound like to establish a boundary with my in-laws saying, like, please don't feed my kid high fructose corn syrup, or please don't take them to this church that I don't believe in, or, hey spouse, I actually think I want a divorce. Like, what are the things that you say in these really tumultuous, polarizing situations? So that's kind of what I do in my little corner of the internet.
Yeah. So that is so cool. And so tell me about that, like, transition period when you're having all this strife with your family and stuff. And then you kind of had this, like, epiphany of, this is how I'm going to stand up for myself. How did you then transition to, okay, this is working really well for me and I'm able to, like, live my best life? How did you then start working with people on how to coach them through that?
Well, what's interesting, it was kind of harmonious, because when I first started my coaching practice, which was well over 10 years ago now, I went to coaching school in the mid-2000s, so it's been a minute. And I originally was all things relationships. So it was genuinely how to make marriage work, what was my kind of niche at the time. And what I was noticing in my work, as I was focusing primarily on relationships, that a lot of women were lacking in the belief in who they were, a lot around the self-worth piece, a lot around forgiving themselves or forgiving other people, letting go of blame, so that they could find a more strong footing in their relationship. And so instead of really focusing on this symptom of, I need to get through to my spouse or I need to fix my communication, I kind of went back to the basics and we started unearthing a lot of this stuff around self-worth. So then in 2015, I went through a total rebrand and I kind of started looking at this and then building on a lot of the things that I was working through in my own life. I kind of went, oh, this is my sweet spot. It is not just finding your voice, but also how to use it, how to broach boundaries, saying no, and having the semantics and the actual scripts. So it kind of happened as a gradual evolution, I would say. And I ended up going back and looking through past client notes and, you know, what are the things that you most want to get out of things? And that was really helpful to me in figuring out, okay, here is my kind of zone of genius.
Yeah, that's awesome. And then where did the name The Joy Junkie come from?
Oh, well, that was 100% like a business decision. Mm-hmm. One was I realized that, and I'm sure you can definitely attest to this with disordered eating and things like that, that we are all addicted to something. It might be our smartphone. It might be counting calories, God forbid. It might be all of these various things. And I thought, well, what would shift for us if we were equally as addicted to joy as we are to all these other vices that aren't actually bringing us any fulfillment or happiness? But another piece of it was going through trademark processes and things like that. I knew that very realistically, I would change my niche. So if I got involved in health coaching, let's say, or if I got involved in physical fitness or became an accountant, I could still have Joy Junkie Accounting. So part of it was very much a business move, but then also talking about the outcome. You know, what are we actually striving for? When we want the perfect career, when we want the perfect body, when we want the perfect business, we're actually just striving for an emotion we think we're going to feel. We think it's going to bring us freedom, happiness, fulfillment. So I thought, why not really talk about the end result that we're all really looking for?
Yeah. So talk about that. What are the biggest things that are standing in the way of people actually finding that joy?
Oh my gosh, I would say probably, at least from my vantage point, it is a heavy investment in what everybody else thinks. It's that everybody else, even a noble distraction like your child, everybody else's wants, opinions, and needs just are more important than mine, period. And that's how many women disproportionately are raised to believe that self-sacrifice is noble. And one of the things that I say all the time is constantly putting everybody in front of yourself is poison disguised as nobility. We think that it's so valiant. And what it is it's martyrdom. And we're not better parents. We're not better entrepreneurs. We're not better activists or artists. We're not better anything if we're depleted. But we're wired that way. And I don't think at all that it's a snap of the finger and we go, oh, okay, now I'm just going to start putting myself first. So that's what I would say is probably one of the biggest impediment to genuinely finding joy and loving who you are is that everybody else really matters more. And we don't do that consciously. We do that in really subtle ways when our uncle makes a really snide comment and we choose not to say something. It's when somebody is pushy with you at a supermarket and you acquiesce instead of speaking up for yourself. It's being offended in the workplace and not doing anything. It is your in-laws being over. It's that stuff that we think we have all these terms for it. I don't want to rock the boat. I don't want to open up a can of worms. I better sweep it under the rug. We have all these ways to say shut the fuck up and don't actually assert yourself. And it's those micro infractions happening over and over and over and over again that solidify our lack of self-worth. So we wonder, why the hell don't I like myself? And it's like, God, well, a lot of reasons, but one of them is that I'm not flexing anything that says I value me. Yeah. I get worked up.
I mean, that just shows you're passionate about it and you are in the right field, my friend. But I want to go back to one of the things that you very briefly mentioned before is like, we're as women, if we want to get shit done, basically, we have to assert our masculine side and we can't show vulnerability and everything like that. And in these situations that you're talking about, all of those reactions or people, the things that people aren't doing is asserting that masculine side, right? Like, this is the more feminine side of things. It's like, take the back seat, sweep things under the rug. This is what women do, right? But it's funny because if a male CEO is in this position, he's empowered, he's taking charge of things, and a woman is in that same position, she's being a bitch. And it's like, what? You know, and I think this definitely contributes to a lot of the same things is a lot of people are then afraid of asserting that masculine side because they don't want to seem like they're domineering. They don't want to seem like they're the one in charge, or maybe they don't want to seem like, oh, you know, she's trying too hard or whatever it is. So then we kind of take the back seat and our self-worth kind of follows us there. So then we start putting everyone else's needs before our own, and then we neglect to take care of ourselves.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely true. And, you know, I am so thankful for the millennials and Z generation, because I think we're going to start moving away from a lot of these gendered conversations about masculine versus feminine. I would like for us to just get rid of that vernacular altogether and just say strong and soft, because I think there's times when strength is being called for, and I think there's sometimes when softness is being called for. And we all possess the ability to tap into all of those elements. And one of the things that, I mean, that really is sort of the main message that I have, which is you can stand up for yourself without being an asshole, without being a dick. And so that means very softly and assertively saying, I don't think this marriage is going to work. Or hello, adult child, I need you to move out of the house. Or hi, mom and dad, I don't actually believe in the religion you raised me with. You know, there's so, and again, that's not exactly how I would phrase it, but that you don't have to be screaming and yelling in order to be assertive. And I think this whole idea of what feminine looks like, or what women are allowed to do, and what men, you know, and all of these things can really be dispelled if we're just kind in what we deliver. If we say what the hell we mean and we say it kindly. But we're not taught to do that. Like, where are we taught to do that? Nowhere. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the conundrum here is we're also kind of beating around a bush a little bit, but we are talking about chronic people pleasing, right? And one of the things in people pleasing is we believe that we are being kind, and some people do get pleasure and fulfillment out of doing things for other people. But the problem, when this becomes a problem, is when we put everyone's needs before our own constantly. And it also doesn't allow us to truly be in touch with what our own needs are. So can you talk about that chronic people pleasing and why it's so detrimental to not only our mental health and our emotions and our wants and needs, but also our physical health?
Absolutely. Well, first, I do want everybody to kind of give themselves a massive dose of compassion, because we are biologically wired to garner love and affection from other people. So even if we look at something like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, one of the major human needs is a desire for belonging, a need for belonging. So in our ancestors' days, if you did not belong to a tribe, if you were not part of a group, that meant quite literally impending death. So now, many, many years later, that fear response has now become this new iteration of, if these people at this job don't approve of me, I might die. Like, that's what's happening on a subconscious level. That's what's spurring that fear. So everybody out there who's like, how the hell can I shift this? I just want you to know, first and foremost, that we're also going up against some biology here. We're going up against some physiological wiring that is very real. Now, we know that if we get dumped, or if somebody doesn't love us, or God forbid, they think you're too fat, because that's the end of the world. Anyway.
Which needs to be done. Something needs to be done about them, not about you.
That's right. I hope you can see my eye roll through the airwaves. But then we think, I might not get through this. That's how we have anxiety and depression. So with regards to people pleasing, I think one of the biggest things that people can do is just to start ask themselves, where do I chronically complain, chronically and habitually complain? Because almost always, if we're really frustrated in the workplace, our spouse is getting an earful. Or if we're really pissed at our partner, then our bestie's getting an earful. So we express ourselves, we just don't express it to the person who can actually rectify things. And I would also ask yourself the additional question of, and what am I afraid of in broaching a boundary or a tough conversation or setting something up with this person? Because a lot of times those things that we will chronically complain about are the areas where we are locking ourselves into victimhood. And it's usually based off of, I'm choosing silence to make somebody else happy in this situation. And there's a, it was interesting when you were asking me this question about people pleasing. I was thinking, I have a colleague, I don't know if you know Brooke Castillo. She runs the Life Coach School. She always says, people pleasers are fucking liars. And I love so much that perspective, because exactly like what you're saying, we think we're taking care of somebody by saying, oh yeah, I'll be there, or I want to be at your function, or yes, I'll make 400 cupcakes for my kids' school tomorrow. Or yep, you know, we bend and twist and contort thinking I'm making that person happy, but what are we doing? We're lying. We're being inauthentic. And if we were to ask anybody, what do you want in friendships? We don't say, somebody who blows smoke up my ass.
God, I hope not.
Which I found out what that really is about, by the way. I digress, but I found out where that came from, which was literally smoke being blown up someone's ass. In days of old, look it up. It's hilarious. But that is, you know, that really is that big fear, is we think we're actually being mean, but we're not. So for instance, if somebody were to say, hey, Amy, I'm really up a creek and it'd be so helpful to me. Is there any way you could watch my dogs this weekend? Knowing that I had planned a whole weekend of just vegging out, or, you know, and I knew it's going to significantly change how I want to feel that weekend. In that situation, I could very easily say, you know what, I would so love to come to your rescue. Thank you for thinking of me. I'm not going to be able to make it this weekend, or it's not going to work out. I really hope you can understand. You don't have to give this big old explanation. You don't have to over explain. You can just say, I'm not available. I truly hope you can accept that, or I truly hope you can understand. There's a lot of wording around that, that's kind. It's not, you're not being a dick. So stop fueling your mind with that idea. A lot of times I'll tell people, you're only being a bitch if you're actually being a bitch. Not if you have to decline, not if you're not available, not if you can't fit one more client into your roster that week. That is not malicious. You are not ill-intended. So stop calling yourself that. And let's also stop saying, I feel guilty and I feel bad, when you've done nothing wrong according to you.
Amen to that.
Going on that one.
Yeah. Yeah. Talk more about that. Talk about the like verbiage that we use in these situations. Why do we always say sorry and I feel bad if we haven't actually done anything wrong?
Well, I would also say this is also a disproportionate for women. I don't think that by and large a lot of men feel that way, or say that, have a chronic apologizing problem. So here's my take on I feel bad and I feel guilty. So if you're, I know you're a Brené Brown fan. So when Brené talks about the difference between Our Lady Brené, she talks about the difference between shame and guilt. Shame is I am wrong. There's something wrong with who I am. I'm intrinsically flawed. Versus guilt is I've done something wrong. So the way I explain it is, guilt is designed to reroute poor behavior. So if you went and slapped somebody, you should feel bad. You should feel an element of guilt. You did something really shitty. You need to go clean up your mess. However, we say, I feel bad, which is not an emotion, by the way, or I feel guilty, when we've done nothing wrong according to me, according to my barometer. So here's the deal. I had a situation with my mom many years ago where she would continue to invite me to church. And I had to tell her one time, you know, I really appreciate you thinking of me and reaching out. I'll be really honest that I find a lot of that messaging really offensive, and it would really mean the world to me if you would just no longer invite me. And if I'm interested, I promise to you that I will reach out to you. And conversely, I don't share with you books on Wiccan or astrology, or so I would just really like the same respect in return. I truly hope you can understand. So in those situations, a lot of times we go, I could never say that to my mom. I would feel so bad. I would feel so guilty. Now, in that situation, regardless of how my mom responds, right, she might think that's the worst thing she's ever heard. She might be totally understanding. I don't know. None of that has to do with me. So she might deliver that and then hurl guilt my way. Everybody knows those people who love to inflict guilt, like, hey, you're going to take this pile of shit and throw it at you. And then you have the opportunity to either take it, as you're laughing, and you either get to keep it, or you go, oh, I'm currently not accepting any piles of shit right now. And that's what we do when we reject guilt. And we go, no, I actually don't feel poorly about my behavior because I'm only doing something wrong according to you.
And I'm not ready to accept your pile of shit. I'm not currently accepting applications for piles of shit.
Nope. I'm going to need you to hold on to that.
You guys can't see, but I was hysterically laughing when you said that before.
But we think that. We think that it's the end of the world if somebody doesn't like our decision. You know, if somebody doesn't think we should go back to school or take that certain job or... I don't know if you come up against this, people who are naysayers because of the choices you make about your body or about
what
you choose to eat and consume. I deal with that all the time. And I'm like, you get to think whatever you want, but I'm currently not accepting any piles of shit. So boop, don't leave a message.
Yeah. So in that light, talk about, I know you love to talk about your inner shit talker. So like, what does that mean?
Well, really all of this is, and if for any science buffs out there, really all of this is our current homeostasis, which basically means staying the same, just staying the same. Because if I deviate from my norm, that equals unsafe. So in our psyche, we know it's basically two things. This primitive part of our mind, which is 88% of our mind, is our subconscious. It knows knowns and unknowns. So if it knows already how to people please, if it knows how to say, I feel guilty, if it knows how to say, gosh, you're so gross, or you're never going to fit in those skinny jeans, or all this ridiculous narrative that we get from society, then it feels like wildly unsafe for us to start saying, no, I do love who I am. No, I have a healthy relationship with my body. I care about this skin suit that's moving my soul around this planet. You know, that is it, essentially the voice of homeostasis. It's our internal conversation, which, by the way, depending on who you are, will come to you in literal words, or it'll come to you in emotions. So sometimes our inner shit talker or inner critic or ego or saboteur, whatever word you want to use, it's basically that little part of us saying, whoa, we're deviating from the norm. This is wildly unsafe. Better go back to people pleasing. Better go back to talking shit to yourself. We know how to do that. Because what we're doing is we're trying to rewire the neural pathways in the brain, which takes massive repetition. So the same reason why you're so locked into caring what other people think is because that's been on repeat for your entire life, or at least a decade or two. So now we have to really recondition with repatterning and a new message in your mind, whether it's literal, like saying specific statements to yourself on repeat over and over again, or tapping into emotions if you're a little bit more on that, like a concept frequency. For example, if I am like scrolling through Instagram or Facebook or something like that, currently, right now, at this 40-year-old Amy, I get really triggered by things related to successful entrepreneurship. You know, I don't have a ton of shit around my body or my marriage or anything like that, but business? Ooh. But if I'm scrolling and someone's like, make six figures while taking a shit in 2 days, like, you know what I'm talking about? And I'm like, oh, click, clickety click. She's dying again. Okay. And, you know, something like that, I don't hear a voice that says, Amy, you're not going to be successful. I feel my heart fall. And if I unpack that feeling and I go, what's behind that little heaviness in my chest or that heaviness in my belly? What just happened? I can go, oh, my body is making up that just because that person has success, I don't have success, or I'm not good enough. Other people will hear, and I have both. A lot of people will have hybrids where it's an emotional response and you do hear specific words. Sometimes I hear like, oh, that's not possible. Or yeah, good luck with that. Or that was a dumb move, Smitty, or things like that. And then those are a little easier to catch. But your inner critic, again, which we have to remember, is it's just trying to keep us the same because it thinks it's safe, because it's known. So one of the best tactics you can employ with that is to just go, oh, honey, I know you're scared. I know we're trying this new, you know, this new way of intuitive eating, or I know we're deviating from this diet culture, or we're deviating from the scale, or all this shit we've been told to measure ourselves by. I know you're scared, and it's okay. You're allowed to be scared, but we're moving forward. We're creating a new known, a new reality. Yeah.
Yeah, man. Amen to that again. So how does the comparison trap, or like the game of comparison, play into our inner shit talker and everything that you were just talking about?
Yeah, I think the comparison narrative almost always is rooted in this idea of lack and scarcity, meaning if somebody else has success, that must mean I don't, or I can't, or that I'm a loser. So what we don't realize in that moment is that we are taking one snapshot in time, one scenario of somebody else's success, and we're making it mean something about ourselves. Which actually they are completely untethered. They have nothing to do with each other. It is not like, you know, turn this faucet on, water comes out. You know, that is cause and effect, right? It is not if that person is successful, all of a sudden Amy can't be. They're not even related. So one of my favorite tools to use anytime I notice comparison coming up is to say that person actually has nothing to do with me, or that success has nothing to do with me, or to cheer them on and just go, fuck yeah, look what's possible. That's possible for me as well. The other thing that has been helpful for me in comparison situations is to ask, what about this bothers me so much? What I've found is that damn near always when I am finding myself comparing and then getting jealous, I notice that there is something that I'm not pleased with around my own action or inaction, where I'm not happy with what I've been taking care, how I've been taking care of my body, or I'm not happy with the effort that I've put into my business, or there's something where I know I need to call myself to play a bigger game, and seeing that other person's success is a mirror back. It has nothing to do with them. It has nothing to do with meaning that I can't be successful as well, no matter what area that is. Some people, it's anytime they see people who are in loving partnerships and they go, I'll never have that. And that assumption from that one snippet in time to do a stamp on your life of you'll never be loved or you'll never be successful is absolutely irrational. But we have to stop it in the moment and just asking yourself, like, what am I making up about that? What am I making up about that person's success? And then what is really true? What's true is that has nothing to do with me, and I can create whatever I want for my life. And where am I holding myself back that I need to kind of up my game?
Yeah. And then what I'm hearing is also, it might, especially when you're talking about the happy relationship thing and the whole like, oh my God, I'll never be happy, I'll always be alone narrative kind of thing, is there's a two like main things that I can see directly from our conversation today is, on the one hand, there's this biological need to feel belonging, right? And so if you don't feel that, it's like, oh my God, am I ever going to have that? And then we talk ourselves into this narrative like, I am not worthy enough. I don't provide enough value. I need to then chronically people please in order to get someone to love me. But then there's also the other side of things, which is it's the societal perception that if you are alone, then there's inherently something wrong with you. And like you were saying before, it's the repetition that convinces us of this stuff. And if you then hear and see and experience over and over and over again for whatever reason, like all of your friends are getting in relationships and you're not. And then you finally convince yourself there must be something wrong with me. And then you do all these self-sabotaging behaviors and you then convince yourself from the guilt to the shame stage of like, I did something wrong to I am a bad person, or like, I guess you couldn't say I am a wrong person, but like, I am lonely, therefore I'm going to be a lonely person and I'm going to be lonely forever. And then there's also the like bullshit societal messages of like, oh, single girl, get her a pint of Ben & Jerry's, she'll feel better. And then there's also the whole like, oh my gosh, you know that one single friend that you have, like she must be so sad and blah, blah, blah. Whereas you don't know if she's like, I'm a strong independent woman who don't need no man, or like if she's just saying that, but inside she's actually torn apart because she feels like everyone else is judging her, even if they're not, even if they don't give a shit. Oh, so many things.
Yes. Well, I think that they're not always, but I do think that many times judgment externally has a lot to do with judgment internally, meaning, you know, in for me, as an example, when I hired my very, very first assistant years and years ago, I wanted to nitpick the hell out of her. Like, why can't she do this right and do this and do that and do this? And in talking through it with my coach, I realized it was my own perfectionism, that I had such little room, no room for error, that I was projecting that on her. And so I think we get that sometimes too. I've seen that a lot with people who are not partnered and they feel as though it's this beacon of light around them when nobody else really cares, myself very much included. But they do because they are so attached to that story of I am single, therefore I must not be lovable or just less than in some way. And that could be societal, that could be familial too, where we go to a family function and they're like, well, why aren't you married yet? Or when are you, you know, and we say dumb shit like that to each other. And I think it's part of it is habit, part of it's social awkwardness and just not knowing how to talk to each other about shit that really matters. But we have these, what do you do? And are you married? And how many kids do you have? You know, just this dumb stuff.
What kind of car do you drive? Where did you go to school? That's like, oh my God. When I used to live in DC, that's why I honestly hated dating so much, because those are the two things that people ask you. What do you do? Where did you go to school? How about what do you enjoy doing? What lights you up as a person? Who actually are you as a person? I don't care about any of this surface shit. How Yes. about if you want to talk about your job, I hope you enjoy it. Or if you don't, why aren't you trying to pursue something that you do enjoy? Or if you don't enjoy your job, at least what do you do in your spare time to help bring more enjoyment to your life, you know?
Yeah. I love to ask people just kind of like shocker questions, like what kind of messages about money were you taught growing up, you know, or what was the messaging you received around body image growing up? You know, just, I want to talk about things that matter. I don't want to talk about surface stuff. It's a waste of time. Anyway, I digress about all of that, but I do think that this whole societal piece is huge because it takes a fierce, fierce act of courage for us to say, despite all of this messaging that I come across nonstop, I choose to love who I am. I choose to put attention around that. I choose to work on myself. I choose to look at my demons. I choose to get support and get help and not just feel like, okay, as soon as I fit in these skinny jeans, then I'll be happy, because that is elusive and that will change. We change the criteria. When our worth is not rooted internally, it's like the dangling carrot that keeps changing, right? Not only do we never get to it, but all of a sudden it's a radish. Oh shit, I need a radish now? Okay. And then it turns into, you know, a pepper. It's like, but if we already had our worth rooted inside, it would be like, okay, cool. And I have this goal of writing a book and I have this goal of starting this business, but I'm already valuable now. I'm already worthy now. I'm just going to enjoy my journey to that goal instead of hating myself and beating myself up all along the way to the goal. Worth is not something that we can just swing by a self-worth store and pick up. It is 100% created internally. So even if you look up the dictionary definition of self-worth, it will say one's own concept of their value. not here, you need to pass the bar and then become a lawyer. And then we're the ones who change that. And we go, okay, as soon as I lose 10 pounds, oh shit, well, here's another 5. Oh, as soon as I get my teeth fixed, as soon as I this. And then what we are doing, what that translates to is putting off our happiness and joy. Our joy and our happiness now is future. It's future tripping because we're not allowed to be happy now. Because we don't believe that we're valuable enough now. Oh, Dana. So I get going.
How do we get to that point where we have convinced ourselves that I cannot be happy now with where I am and that I am not worthy enough now or enough now where I am right now?
You know, I think to answer that question, truly how we form all of our beliefs is usually between kind of the ages of 8 and 12. And what happens is we start to see things that are happening in our environment, how we grow up, what's being modeled for us. And no matter what it is, we take the facts of the situation and we interpret that in some way. So depending on how you grew up or what your circumstances were, you might have said, oh, okay, considering I have a special needs brother and my parents give all the attention to him, the only way for me to stand out, the only way for me to garner any attention in my family is to become an overachiever. Or some people, it's to become a rebel. Maybe I'll get attention if I start doing drugs and I get in trouble. We do all sorts of things once we've created that interpretation of, here's what I need to do to stay safe. Here's what I need to do to be seen. Here's what I need to do to be loved. And we pick a tactic. Some people choose perfectionism. Some people choose people pleasing. Let me just make everybody else more happier. Some people choose addictions. Some people choose noble things like scholastics or academia. But we decide, here's who I'm going to be. This is how I'm going to be safe. And then we nurture that over and over again through our internal self-talk. So a lot of times we can look at the same messaging that we were telling ourselves in high school. Now it's just a new iteration. So now it's not just that so-and-so isn't going to like you, or you're not going to make the cheer squad, or you're not going to make that drama show or whatever. Now it's, you're never going to find a spouse. You're never going to get pregnant. You're never going to have the home you want. You're never going to write that book. It's the same goddamn thing. We've just changed topics. So the answer to that is to figure out, how can we start changing how we speak to ourselves? And how can we start changing that actual belief, which I think of a lot as almost like the roots of a tree. So the roots of the tree are our belief system. So shocker for everybody out there, almost everybody has a deep-seated belief, something around worth. I am not lovable. I am not enough. I am not valuable. I don't deserve happiness. All of those things are wrapped up into enoughness, worthiness. And then as the branches come up, we have all of our self-talk. Oh, you're never going to write that book. Oh, you'll never fit into those pants. Oh, you did it. All that chatter, or emotions that we feel. And then we are reactionary to that. That's what makes us procrastinate. That's what makes us text our ex, even though we know it's not a good solution. But we do it because we go, oh, maybe that'll make me feel better. Instead of fixing the roots of the tree, which is the only thing that's going to yield different fruit. It's the only thing that's going to spring different branches. And that is truly kind of the nucleus of what I do in my work. And that takes, like I said, repetition, and it takes, you know, my main kind of signature program that I do, we go for almost 4 months for that reason, that we've conditioned this belief for so many years. We now need to condition a new belief that supersedes that. And that does take time for most people, because there's that kickback of like, no, Amy, I am not good enough. I am for sure not pretty enough. I'm for sure not smart enough. And we want to dig in. Why? Because our body wants to stay in homeostasis. It goes, this is what's familiar. It's scary to be confident. We can't be confident. We can't know. Ah, better hold on to all this bullshit. And that's not working, right? It's not working. So if you plan on being here in 10 years, 5 years, 1 year, we might as well be happier by the time we get there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's scary for people to even consider that there's another possibility than what is the situation right now, because even if where you are right now has you feeling really crappy, right now is your comfort zone. I talk about this all the time with my clients, both in my group coaching programs and with individual clients. It's like, yeah, quitting diet culture and breaking free of that cycle is freaking scary, because how long have you been doing this? Because from the diet culture messaging, you've been told this is the way to feel better about yourself. So when you then decide to flip that on its head and say, no, this is actually not the way that I'm going to feel better about myself and happier and feel like I'm enough and worthy and everything, even though that's what you've been told, of course you're scared shitless, because it's like, well, I don't know what's actually out there and no one's giving me a roadmap and there's no surefire way to get there in 30 days or whatever it is like a diet will promise you. So of course you're terrified. And that's why I try and encourage people to step into the uncomfortable a little bit and try and let go of control. Because a lot of people think, when we're talking about food and body image specifically, is that the way to feel better about yourself in both of those realms is to get more control over your food, more control over your body. When really the answer is to get more comfortable with being not in control of everything, because the control and the need to control is what got you here in the first place. And the attempt to control everything is actually, funnily enough, what makes you feel completely out of control.
That's right. That's right. And again, that is a fierce act of courage to go, this freaks me the fuck out to not count my macros, to not count my calories, or how many protein grams have I had, you know? But that's also because that's a neural pathway in the brain that is well-worn. If we think about, from a scientific standpoint, how this works with any type of habit, which is very much ingrained in the subconscious part of our brain. So what happens when we are trying to make change, whether it's changing how we feel about our bodies, whether it's changing what we're consuming, whether it's changing our relationship with money, whether it's changing how we view love, our self-worth, doesn't matter. We have, it's almost like if you can imagine or visualize a pathway, like an actual road. And the one you're on right now, that let's use the people pleasing one, it's a well-worn path. Okay. That neural pathway, it is paved and smooth sailing. You know how to walk through that over and over and over again. But the minute you want to change and you want to go, okay, no, let me go down this other path. But this path is overgrown with shrubs and foliage and bushes. So you're standing there with a machete going, Dana said this is gonna work. Amy said this is gonna work. And you cut a branch. You cut a branch and you're like, okay, I'm gonna sit. But this path is worn over here. Can't we just go run down this? Oh no, it's diet culture. Oh God, okay, machete out again. Okay, let's try cutting a few more branches. Oh, it's so uncomfortable and my arm's sore. That's what's happening. So we have, chemically in our brain, that neural pathway that's well-worn, we will always want to go back to that until we have stuck with something so long and with repetition that we've carved out a new path, so much so that the old one can overgrow with shrubs and bushes and foliage. And now we have a new norm, a new way. And that is really what we're doing. So that's why, if you have that visual or that picture of you standing in front of just shrubs going, I need to make a pathway here. That's why it feels hard. Because it takes effort, or else we'd all just have it. Everybody would be happy. Everybody would be self-actualized and confident and believe in themselves. But we sure as hell don't have that, do we? So we have to continue to pick up that machete, keep carving it until that path becomes well-worn. And that's also, I'm sure you see this too, why people go, this is too hard and my arm hurts and I'm going to stop and go back down this other path. Because it's easier. It is easier. And it also sucks. So if you really want something to change, it's about commitment and it's about repetition. So, you know, and I don't know if you talk about this at all too, but with willpower is actually housed in the conscious part of the brain, which is only 12% of the mind. So, and it fatigues like a muscle. So at the end of the day, if you've been quote good, which let's stop saying that, if you've done whatever you need to do throughout the day and then you're just exhausted from work, and then that's when you make a choice that you beat yourself up over, that whole cycle, which is nonsense anyway. But that's why at the end of the day, it's harder for us to work on our business. We are already fatigued. Our willpower has fatigued. But habit is a part of the subconscious. And the only way we can make habit is through repetition. And that is the same thing for how we speak to ourselves, how we speak about our bodies, what we decide we believe about diet culture or about intuitive eating. We've already been given the compass. We've already been given the intuition. So I would probably argue the same way. I'm just going to go out on a limb about intuitive eating as much as intuitive guidance as far as our emotional selves. We've already been given that compass. We come fully equipped. We're fully loaded to know exactly what we need to do to consume the foods that feel good to our system, or the people that feel good to our system. Like, oh, note to self, so-and-so in the office who is always spewing venom doesn't feel good to my system. Better abort mission. Go hang out with Sally in accounting. She's a lot better. You know, whatever. But yeah, our intuition is there for us already. We just ignore it. I call it the cognitive override, where we just go, oh no, well, I should reach out to them, or I should say this, or all the bullshit that we get fed about how we should be, mm-hmm. instead of what we intuitively feel.
Right. So in order to get back in touch with that intuition in all areas of our life, right? Like you said, we've already been given the compass, but there are all of these things like perfectionism and chronic people pleasing and not having confidence in selves and in ourselves and societal norms of what we should and shouldn't be doing. How can we, one, start to tune back into that, and then at the same time say no and establish boundaries when we know, or our experience has been, right, that we believe that saying yes to others is going to give us more value and worthiness. And that is the habit path that we've formed. So how can we get back in touch with that? And how do we start saying no without feeling like we're going to blow up like an atomic bomb?
Yeah. So I would love to give you, okay. First of all, intuition, I feel it is just like consuming different foods, right? Like if you consume a type of food and you throw up, your body's like, hey, Amy, this doesn't work with your system. Knock it off. And we go, okay, aptly noted, won't do that again. So if we can take the messaging that our body is sending us, which usually comes through pain. For example, I have issues with my knees. And so I know when my knee pain flares up, it's not the avenue for me to go, oh, I hate my body so much, or why can't you do the workouts we used to do? It's for me to go, oh, what's that, knees? Oh, what's that? You're sharing something with me? Oh my God, honey, I'm so sorry. I've been neglecting you. I'm coming to your rescue. Let's get some ice. Let's do some foam rolling, you know, instead of hating ourselves. Okay, because I'm the one who overextended. I'm the one who needs to pay the penance and help my knees out, come to the rescue. And the same is true for how we feel intuitively. If we are around somebody who we don't feel right in our gut, that's for us to kind of unpack and come home and go, wait a minute, what didn't feel right about that scenario? Is it that person? Is it how I engaged with them? But we have to unpack that in order to figure out what is intuition and what is societal conditioning. And at the beginning, it feels very, very muddled, especially those of you who've been raised with any type of spiritual dogma, because with those sorts of messages, there is a very definitive right and wrong, and this is who you are and this is who you are not. Similar to my husband and I just moved to the South about a year and a half ago. There is a Southern way to be. There's a Southern like right and wrong, and kind of bucking that stereotype can feel wildly unsafe. So, but that's about honing that intuition instead of that conditioning that we've received. Now, I will say, in all the personal development concepts of all time, I think intuition is probably one of the hardest, because it is so incredibly nuanced. And I think of it like my own spirituality. I think of it like a sixth sense. So if I can smell something, if I can taste something, or if I can intuitively feel into something, that usually is going to give me a little bit better insight. But just like a muscle that hasn't been worked out, your intuition can atrophy. But you have to start working it out again and do it in really small situations. Maybe watching a newscast and just feeling into that, like, okay, that seems really wrong to me. Wait a minute. Is that really wrong to me because of what I have been raised to believe? Or is that really wrong because in my bones, I couldn't condone what I'm seeing on that show or on that newscast or whatever? And just start experimenting when the stakes aren't high, where you can just feel into things a little bit. With regards to saying no. Oh my gosh, this is a whole can of worms. But what I would love is to just give you a couple of easy tactics. The first is to buy yourself some time. So this is, again, just like the semantics, the logistics. I'm not gonna overstep the fact that you still need to believe internally that you deserve to have your voice heard. So that's a whole nother piece. But as far as what to do, just buy yourself some time. Instead of saying yes, say something like, you know what, how soon do you need to know? Throw it back to them. Or I'm going to need to check my calendar. How quickly do you need to know the answer? Or I'm going to need to double check that. Something like that. Even if you are like, you know what, can you hold that thought? I'm so sorry. I've got to run to the bathroom. I'll be right back. Just to give yourself a little bit of bandwidth so you can wrap your head around, like, do I really want to chaperone that that field trip, right? Because most of the time we're gut response, we're like, sure, oh my gosh, yes. Or, you know, from where I was raised in California, it was being the totally girl. Totally, absolutely, yeah, totally. And I didn't want to be that anymore because it ended up that I would sacrifice all these other things that I needed in my life, like rest and connection with, you know, my partner and all of those things. So buying yourself some time. Don't lie. Don't make up shit. Don't say I have a Beyonce concert if you just want to wash your hair that night. And that's just say I've got plans. That's fine. So don't lie. Don't over explain. Don't say, well, I got this and then this and then this and then this. Just say, you know what? I'm not available. I wish I could be. Man. But thank you for thinking of me. All you have to do is politely decline. That's it. But the first piece of that with saying no is committing to doing so, committing to not just saying yes. One of the other things that I will oftentimes use is saying, you know, I would hate to pull out last minute, or I would hate to leave you up a creek. I would hate to whatever. I'd hate to overcommit and not be able to come through. Let me run this by my calendar real quick. Something like that. And then you can decide what you want to say. It gives you a little bit more time to politely decline.
Yeah, I love that. And I feel like those are three things that so many people have so much trouble doing, you know? So if you were to say a couple of books, resources, whatever, that have been really helpful to you in doing those three things, and really just like learning, for people to learn more about what we've been talking about today, what are some of those things that were helpful for you that you would recommend to like anyone?
Ooh. Well, Our Lady Brené. I would join the church on Lady Brené Brown. Anything from Brené is amazing. Her recent book on leadership is pretty incredible as well. Dare to Lead. I love, for those of you out there who are just kind of getting into this and perhaps your first dipping your toe into the personal development waters have been through the lens of diet culture or weight, or fitness, you might also enjoy Lori Harder's work. She has a new book called A Tribe Called Bliss. And I love, love, love Jen Sincero. She has a book called You Are a Badass. That's a great kind of intro to personal development in a way that is very palatable to receive. It's not esoteric and super woo-woo. She's very, very down to earth. As far as boundaries, I have not really heard a book that I'm writing one, but I have not really heard of any book necessarily that I've been like, yes, that's what it's all about. Rachel Hollis talks about it a little bit in Girl, Wash Your Face, which I do think is really good. It has a little bit of a faith-based slant to it. So depending on where you stand with that.
I also do not like what she says about diets and stuff, but pretty much everything else in that book is pretty good.
You know what? I was actually thinking about that today. I was thinking, because she does talk about calories in, calories out, and I was going, I bet.
Oh, my eyes are rolling in the back of my head.
I know. But you know what? I would also think that she might entertain a conversation around that. And I don't know. I just think sometimes when we know better, we can do better. And when we don't know that necessarily until we hear other people's perspective around, because we're all part of the patriarchal society. We're all part of this idea of like, women don't have hair, so you better shave all your body parts. And, you know, you can't have stretch marks and you can't have this. And here's all these aisles of beauty products. But yeah, I know, it's just, we're all sort of part of that. So it gets challenging to decipher, like, where do I really want to take a stand here? You know? Mm-hmm. So I think we need to be gentle with ourselves too, of like, okay, I'm working on this one step at a time, right? One step at a time. But yes, don't pay attention to that one part.
Don't pay attention to the man behind the curtain. There's nothing to see here.
Yes, nothing. Look away.
Oh man. Well, I don't want to keep you for too long. So thank you so, so much for coming on. I know people are going to want to know more from you and hear more from you. So tell everyone where they can find you.
Yeah. So my little corner of the internet is my website. It's called thejoyjunkie.com. Junkie is J-U-N-K-I-E. And I've been doing a podcast for 6 years now. My husband's my little sidekick. And we talk about a lot of these topics. I think I've done one body image one, but a lot around speaking up with family or self-worth or trust or control issues. So if any of that stuff really resonated, come hang out. It's kind of the hub, so you should be able to find freebies. I have free workshops. I have a free ebook, Stand Up for Yourself Without Being a Dick, that has a bunch of challenges that can get you into action around self-worth. So yeah, tons of free stuff, and pretty much everywhere on the internet, I'm under the handle The Joy Junkie. So come stalk me out.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on.
I had a blast. Thanks, Dana.
Thanks for listening to Real Talk with Dana. If you enjoyed the episode, please share it with your family and friends and share the love by throwing us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes, which will help spread the word and do a small part to correct all of the fitness and nutrition misinformation or bullshit that's out there, which is only causing people to become more unhealthy. Come find me anywhere at Real Food with Dana on Instagram and Facebook. Join the Real Talk with Dana Facebook group for more support and discussion on these episodes. And come hang out over on realfoodwithdana.com for the show notes and totally epic and delicious recipes.